4 years ago, I gave a two-hour masterclass on fibro that really was heavy in pathophysiology, neuroanatomy, all the things that interest me and I thought would interest people, but this is going to be none of that. This is treatment, and there's some new things about fibromyalgia that you need to know. So, nothing really to disclose other than, as Barkin would say, I pay taxes. Okay, so what is fibromyalgia? There is something new here, okay? If you ask me, it's still what I said it was 4 years ago, and people are starting to catch up. It is a central hypersensitivity disorder. It is not a pneumonia, which is a cut in time and area with a specific bacterium. It's not that type of disease anymore. This is now on a continuum. Therefore, a patient can have fibromyalgia today, maybe not tomorrow, and then they would have it again on the next day. And we're going to talk about how that works. But central sensitization, okay, is associated with allodynia, hyperalgesia. We'll talk about it. It's useful to consider patients with fibromyalgia or central pain as multifocal pain, as well as other somatic symptoms, because we're not just talking physiological issues here. Okay? You need to treat this disorder with a medical disorder. And here you see dyscog or fibrofog, fatigue, mood disturbances, anxiety, physical dysfunction, sleep problems, stiffness, sexual dysfunction, and pain. Now, the prevalence is still high. One out of three Americans, that's that 100 million people, which account for pain. And that is one of 40% of all outpatient physician visits are secondary to acute pain. Chronic widespread pain, I know there was another lecture either before or later, is present in 10 to 30% of the population in countries around the world, as I'll show you in the next slide. Almost every population that has been evaluated and studied, basically chronic musculoskeletal pain is ubiquitous. Here you can see in the US, 10% of people have chronic widespread pain, though this slide is from 2006. And you can see down Norway, 30% of the population with chronic widespread pain. That's enormous. Now, as somebody told me the other day, and pardon me if you're in the audience for my stealing your joke, you know, this is putting the cart before, the horse before the cart over here. Okay, it was bad. I'm sorry. Anyway, on the left you see Descartes' philosophy. A person has nociceptive pain, goes to the back, to the spine, up into the brain. But now we've had to turn this on a little over its head, because it's not just simply the pain, okay? We have nociception here, but now we have to look at what type of injury. Is it peripheral? Is it a central problem? Is it post-stroke? Is it car accident? Chemical and structural issues, okay? Atrophy versus opioidergic and dopaminergic dysfunction in those systems. Okay, genetics, we now know, and we talked about before, and I'll talk a little bit about abnormalities, polymorphisms of the mu receptor. Let's see, beliefs, okay, do you have, what type of beliefs? Placebo effect and nocebo effect. Mood, depression, anxiety, catastrophizing, and cognitive, attention, distraction, control, hypervigilance, again, catastrophizing. And if you're getting the idea that all this has to be placed right with the nociception here, you're right, and there are probably five other things that we're not going to talk about today. So central pain has been used to describe all sorts of things. And by the way, we'll get finished with this stuff in about 10 minutes, and then we'll go into treatment, because that's what everybody wants to hear, I know. All right, so we thought to explain pain, and it arose only from pathology in the central nervous system, but that's really not true. If somebody has a thalamic stroke, you'd have central pain, but that is from a physiological problem, okay, an organic problem, stroke. Now, central pain is known not to be related to structural damage, specifically like that thalamic stroke, and it's rather to dysfunction in the pain perception. So what makes fibromyalgia new now is before it was considered a disorder, but now it's on a continuum. It's not a specifically defined disorder, though I'll go over exactly how to diagnose it. It's on a continuum. And it describes central nervous system, brain, spinal cord, amplification of pain. In other words, you have your normal pain pathways and the ability to perceive pain, but this amplifies everything. So what you think you're feeling, you know, pain, somebody pinches you and it's like maybe this much on a pain scale, you feel this much. That's called what? Hyperalgesia, right? You have a little noxious stimuli, but you feel it a lot more. And allodynia is pain from non-painful stimuli. And both of these issues you will see in central pain dysfunction. Okay, now, fibro was thought to be discrete, as I said. So basically, this is what we talked about. This slide is from the 1990 diagnostic criteria. Do you remember this? Everybody talked about tender points. To have fibromyalgia, you had to have 11 out of 18 positive tender points. Well, in the new criteria for fibromyalgia, you don't need to do a diagnosis. What we've learned is, and for reasons I'll tell you in a moment, the diagnosis really complicates things. And the new diagnostic criterion actually has exploded the diagnosis. So there's a paradigm shift, okay, in fibromyalgia. Before, we thought it was a disorder specific to one thing. Now it's considered a part of a continuum, somatic and diffuse, tenderness, psychological, behavioral factors have a significant role. What are the characteristics? It's pain in multi-body parts. Okay, as you'll see in a couple of slides when I show you how to diagnose it. Okay, it's pain in multiple areas. If you only have pain in one area, by definition, it's not going to be fibromyalgia. But you have multiple other symptoms. So again, these symptoms are so widespread, they don't fall into a pain anatomical site in the brain, on the homunculus, if you will. Fatigue, fibrofog, memory difficulties, sleep disturbances. The premier sleep disturbance here, you may remember, is an alpha intrusion, alpha wave, fast intrusion into stage 4 sleep. Okay, that's why you have non-refreshing sleep in the morning, because you wake up at stage 4 and you never go past that into stage 5 or REM sleep. Okay, mood disturbances, heightened responses to pain, we talked about excessive response to other stimuli. If you look at you're talking to a fibromyalgia patient and a loud noise occurs, they'll jump. Okay, bright lights suddenly turned on, they'll jump. Smells, strong odors will make them very uncomfortable and increase their pain. And the examination is typically negative. Tender points, feh. Okay, I'll tell you something else that you need to look for that's better. So, clinical features of fibro, fatigue, we talked about these things, but the frequency of common symptoms, 98% have what? They have widespread pain. And then you have fatigue, memory problems, sleep discomfort, paresthesias, headache, and so on. So these patients are not dealing just with pain. They're dealing with a host of issues. That is one reason that it's on a continuum of pain amplification, because what helps amplify pain is that whole limbic system area. Okay, so this is your typical fibromyalgia patient, okay? These folks have headache. All right, memory and cognitive difficulties, dry eye, dry mouth. They have affective disorders, very frequently psychiatric diagnosed disorders, TM joint disorder, vestibular complaints, multiple chemical sensitivity or allergic disorders, which is why we're going to talk about medications for treatment. And I'll say this probably three times in this hour. Fibromyalgia patients churn their medications. You give them a medication, and it works great for a week or two, and then they get every symptom, every AE that's in the PDR. Okay? And so they come back in 2 months, I want another drug. You put them on another drug, they're back in 3 months, they want another drug. And so by the end of a year or so, you're starting them back on the drug you originally started them on. Okay? And that's called churning. Okay? Now, they get esophageal symptoms, okay, this problem swallowing. Neurally mediated hypotension, one of the diagnoses everybody in my neuro department hates is POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, okay, which is supposedly from dysautonomia. But people, when they see a patient, immediately think, oh, they're crazy. They're not crazy. It's a real diagnosis. Okay, non-cardiac chest pain, idiopathic low back pain, irritable bowel syndrome, non-dermatomal paresthesias, and pelvic and bladder symptoms, okay? And interstitial cystitis is more disturbing to these people and to non-fibro patients than almost anything else. But this is the melange that you see in the patients with fibromyalgia, okay? So again, we've talked about that. So there's a lots of fibromyalgia out there. One of the important points is that the 2010 diagnostic criteria has enlarged the whole group of fibromyalgia patients by increasing markedly the number of men that are now diagnosed with fibromyalgia. It used to be women, about 10 to 1. Now, not at all like that. In the U.S., 3 to 7% of the population has fibromyalgia. Average age, 30 to 70 years of age in women. Okay, it is still more common in women, but nowhere it's more like a 4 to 2 or a 2 to 1. Okay. So here's the new diagnostic criteria. Okay, it's more sensitive, as we talked about, and here's the diagnoses. You have to have a widespread pain index greater than or equal to 7, and I'm going to show you how to figure this out, and a symptom severity scale score of greater than or equal to 5. And how do you find these numbers? The patient gets a 2-page document that they mark up, and that's how you describe it. Here you have this cartoon. And there are 19 areas. Hello. There are 19 areas of pain. And so you ask the patient to draw something next to everything that hurts them. And so you get a number. You get the number, and you write that number down. So let's say the number was 8. 8 areas of pain. And by definition, they are both above and below the waist, and they're bilateral. Then the symptom severity score has two parts. The first part is fatigue, waking unrefreshed, and cognitive symptoms, each on a 0 to 3 scale. So maximum they can get there is 9 points, okay? And then, so you put down the number over here, that's 9. And then they get this, 41 different symptoms. And they're asked, circle or check every symptom you've had in the last week. Okay? So it's not unusual at a 41 to have people coming up with, okay, 15, 20. All right, so let's say it was 15. So your score for part 2B is entered right there. It's 15. And then you look over here. Count up the number of symptoms checked above. If you tallied 15, that's 11 to 24, give yourself a score of 2. So then you add these. 2 plus 9 is 11. Oops. Okay, 2 plus 9 is 11. All right, so then part 2 is 11. Part 1 is 9. So you fit your wide area pain index is greater than or equal to 7, you're a 9. And over here, your subjective, your symptom score is greater than or equal to 5. It's higher, it's 11. So what do you have? You have a patient with fibromyalgia and they filled it out. You give it to them, have them fill it out, and you make the additions, make sure they're correct. But that's how to make the diagnosis today. After this, you take your history, and then you do a normal neurological examination. You don't have to be concerned about the 18 tender points, but what is found in 70%, 60 to 70% of fibromyalgia patients is typically a cervical myofascial pain syndrome, which is totally different. Okay, muscle spasm, active trigger points, not tender points, trigger points. Okay, and as we go into treatment, there's a question about what about injecting tender points? Doesn't really work much. Injecting the trigger points for the myofascial pain, that will help the patient. You're getting rid of the cervical myofascial pain problem, which will make the patient feel a lot better. And again, that's a nice thing to do without drugs. So these are the criteria from 2010. Diagnostic tests, when you want to work up the patient, there's really not a lot to do. Okay, x-rays, not helpful. Unless on examination, you find, on neurological examination, for instance, you find evidence of a peripheral neuropathy or a radiculopathy. In those cases, you may want to do some more work, like an EMG, nerve conduction velocity. Okay. Now, differential diagnosis of fibro, it's relatively everything that you would assume. Okay, virus, rheumatoid arthritis, RA, OA, lupus, polymyalgia rheumatica, myositis, neuropathy is most important for these patients. Differential diagnosis, hypothyroidism, rheumatoid diseases, RA, OA, SLE, spinal stenosis, okay? Inflammatory myopathies, neuropathies, and the rest you can read. But OSA, obstructive sleep apnea. Didn't think of that one, okay? Mood and anxiety disorders. This is part of that differential diagnosis. So the presence of these disorders does not exclude fibromyalgia, as it can be a concomitant or secondary to another diagnosis. In other words, if a patient has lupus, they may absolutely have a fibromyalgia syndrome on that continuum, but to treat it, you need to treat the lupus. Okay? So, fibromyalgia should be considered after the symptoms have persisted at least 3 months. Before then, you can't make the diagnosis. It is similar to chronic headache or depression. It's not an all or nothing diagnosis anymore. And it's been measured by severity of the symptoms as given to you by the patient. Okay? So the fibro is a prototype for a new form, a fundamentally different form of pain syndrome, where the pain is not due to inflammation or peripheral tissue. Okay, frequently it's accompanied by a variety of both somatic and non-somatic problems. So you want to look at that. So here we go, folks, treatment. Okay, now there are three medications that have been approved by the FDA for the treatment of fibromyalgia. The first one, Pregab, was approved in 2007. And we'll go into the pathoetiology, but basically that's an alpha-2-delta ligand. Okay, duloxetine, 2008 was approved. That's an SNRI, and in the second SNRI, milnacipran. Okay, and those are the three that are approved. But the first drug we're going to talk about is one that was not FDA approved for fibromyalgia, but is probably the most helpful. TCAs, tricyclic antidepressants, okay? Particularly amitriptyline, okay? 25 to 50 milligrams a day, or cyclobenzaprine, 10 to 40, okay? TCAs are effective for all clinical outcomes: pain, quality of sleep, fatigue, sense of well-being, okay? Safety and tolerability issues, you know, you don't want to use this on a male over 60 years of age. But other than that, you're okay. Everybody, anybody, remember Harvey Moldofsky and his work in fibro, anybody? Harvey, in the 70s, did the first really appropriate study. He was an amazing guy. He took about 20 college football jocks and hooked each one up to an EEG every night. And when they got to stage 3 sleep, he woke them up. Okay? And he did that for 2 weeks for about 20 of them. And what happens, aside from the fact they wanted to kill them, okay? They had all the musculoskeletal type dysfunction, sleep disorder, they had fibro fog, they had all these things going on. And so Harvey said, interesting, let's put them on amitriptyline, 10 to 25 milligrams. And within 2 weeks, they were all better. That was the first real fibromyalgia study. Okay, though it was fibrositis at the time. But one of the other thing that's very important for you to realize, remember I told you that in fibromyalgia, there's an alpha intrusion into stage 4 sleep. Okay, so that means that the sleep architecture is abnormal. And that's what Harvey did. He woke them up when they got into stage three of sleep. And so what happened was the fast alpha waves took over stage 4, so they couldn't get back to sleep. So what's important for you to know is amitriptyline is the only drug that will fix abnormal sleep architecture. The only one. So here's a study, nicely done, looking at amitriptyline and naproxen in fibromyalgia. So over here, you have both, okay? You had amitriptyline and on the left, and then there was naproxen, and then the third was naproxen and amitriptyline and then placebo. And what you see is that the amitriptyline and naproxen group and the amitriptyline group were statistically significant. There was no movement whatsoever or any significance whatsoever in terms of treatment for naproxen. So it's really dealing with the TCA. It's not the naproxen because naproxen standing as tall as the placebo group. Then here's another study with amitriptyline and fluoxetine. Okay, and here is amitriptyline, here is fluoxetine, and here's the combination. And looking at the fibromyalgia impact questionnaire as well as the pain VAS, statistically significant all the way through. Again, amitriptyline. Now let's go to duloxetine. Okay, now, one of the things is, do you remember what a TCA is? A TCA increases serotonin it inhibits both serotonergic and noradrenergic reuptake. Okay, and what does an SNRI do? It inhibits norepinephrine more than serotonergic reuptake. That's what makes it different than fluoxetine, which is an SSRI. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So that's why the SNRIs, they're just the two of them, there's no approved SSRI for this. So here you see at 3 months, duloxetine 60, duloxetine 60 BID or 120, here's placebo, was very positive. This is 0.5, this is 0.01, okay? 6 months wasn't so positive. The duloxetine study treated female, and this is important, okay, because this is what's called sexual dimorphism, all right? Female subjects had significantly greater improvement than most efficacy measures with duloxetine versus male subjects. The males didn't do as well. Okay, so that's something you want to think about before you start treating a male fibromyalgia patient with duloxetine. Okay? Here's another primary efficacy measures by gender. Okay, here is the FIQ score. Okay, here's women, positive. Men, not so positive. All right, and here is pain score, positive for male and female. Female and male, pardon me. Now, this is a type of graph you're going to see for all three of these. This is placebo, 12 weeks, and this are the two doses of duloxetine. Okay, and this is done on the brief pain inventory. And here's another study, 6-month RCT. And by the way, fibro is the only disease process I know in the pain group that has had 2 6-month studies, because what the FDA demands is a 12-week study, 3-month study. But Pfizer for Lyrica and another company for this did 6 months studies. So this is pretty significant. And what you can see here is efficacy and safety of duloxetine, and here's the brief pain inventory. You see decrement here, whereas duloxetine and placebo with patient improvement. It was positive both times. Now, milnacipran, the other MSRI. Now, I'm using studies, by the way, that enabled the FDA to approve these. That's why these are not new studies. I specifically wanted to show you the studies that made the FDA say, oh, this works fine for fibro. So that's why we're using them. So here is milnacipran versus placebo on patient global scores. Okay, patient global improvement. Okay, and you see if you use it twice a day, if you use it once a day, improvement is markedly significant at p equal 0.003. That's nice. And placebo, as you can see, nothing. So in the first trial, they used 100 milligrams of milnacipran, and then once a day, then twice a day, versus placebo. Okay, and you saw improvements in pain, global well-being, fatigue, and other domains. And here is that infamous chart with your placebo on top and the two doses of milnacipran below. Now, pregabalin, okay, both pregabalin and gabapentin are two of a school or a group of anticonvulsants called gabapentinoids. Amazing, isn't it? Gabapentin, gabapentinoid, wow, who would have thunk it? But what happens is you have pregabalin and gabapentin both work the same way. And I'll tell you a trick after this. They bind to the alpha-2-delta subunit of voltage-gated calcium channels in neurons. And it reduces the calcium influx, which inhibits the release of pain-inducing chemicals like, glutamate, which is highly activating, and substance P. So here is proportion of responders of pregab in fibromyalgia. What's fascinating about this is you didn't see anything positive at 150 and 300. It was very positive, 0.003 at 450 milligrams a day. I point that out because it's so frequent that I see patients, were you on pregabalin? Oh, yeah. How much do you take? 50 BID. And how long did you take it? 2 months. Oh, and did it help you? No. And then you look at this and say, how come it didn't help them? All right. So this pivotal trial was fascinating. This is one of the longer ones that Pfizer did. They looked at 130, 300, 450. And what's important is 450 milligrams a day significantly improved average severity of pain. Okay? But more patients in the group had 50% or greater pain relief at that dose. But pregabalin at 300 and 450 associated with significant improvement in sleep quality, fatigue, and global measures of improvement, not pain specifically. All right. And pre-GAB 450 improved several other domains of health-related function. Dizziness and somnolence were the most frequent AEs, and rates of discontinuation were about the same in all four groups. Okay. Now, before we go further, let me tell you a trick. Okay. A lot of people, if you're treating neuropathic pain, or not so much fibromyalgia, but neuropathic pain with gabapentin, the typical best region is 1,800 milligrams a day. Remember, you can go up to 3,600, but above 1,800 milligrams a day, you have decreased bioavailability. So I max out typically at 1,800 a day. But if the patient isn't feeling as well as I had hoped, I will mix, here's the trick, I will mix about 25 to 50 BID of pregabalin with it. And you're going to say, well, they're both gabapentinoids. Yes, but the side chains on pregabalin are different than gabapentin, and 8 out of 10 patients get significant improvement. Something for you to think about. I won't go higher, typically, than 600 TID, 1,800 milligrams of gabapentin. And if that doesn't give a patient what I was hoping for, I will add pre-GAB, depending on the size, weight, and so on of the patient and the amount of pain. I'll use pre-GAB because the side chains are different and you get basic synergy. And I'd go 25 to 50 BID, and in some cases, really big people, TID. So here again, in this 14-week trial, here's your placebo. It was significant except for the 11th week, when all of a sudden the placebo dropped right next to the upper dose. So you had significance in all these weeks except for week 11. Interesting how that happens. And one of the reasons most pain drugs fail in development is placebo response. So here's the patient global impression of change, right up there, positive statistically for 300, 450, and even 600. Now, most people have problems tolerating 600 milligrams, and not everybody can tolerate 450 either, just so you know. Now, the most common adverse events, okay, in pre-GAB, okay, there's 6 of them, but just the first 3 are dizziness, okay, somnolence, and headache. Whereas duloxetine, nausea, headache, dry mouth, milnacipran, nausea, headache, constipation. Okay, now, let's talk turkey. Oh, one thing I didn't put on this in this deck because I wanted to keep it short was you can also try naltrexone. And the reason I didn't put it there is there's no good studies, but there are small discussions, if you will, in the literature on the use of naltrexone to treat fibromyalgia. Something else you can put in your back pocket. So anyway, getting back to NSAIDs. There's no study that has ever shown an NSAID to work for fibromyalgia. None. I showed you that one where it was amitriptyline and naproxen, and you notice naproxen didn't move right next to placebo. And that goes with everything else. But wait till you see. Here's the next slide showing taking a group of German fibromyalgia patients, okay, 71% had NSAIDs. Even though they don't effectively treat by what we know in terms of RCTs, okay? And then antidepressants, opioids, look at that, opioids, 30-odd percent, okay? And then you'll see benzos, corticosteroids, sedative hypnotics, and so on. So this just, I wrote this out so you'd see 66% of fibro patients received the recommended pharmacological treatment, one of the 3. Physical therapy was given in 59% of those fibro patients. You can't do that here in this country, unless you're possibly in the VA. Okay, how many patients have insurance that'll pay for physical therapy that's appropriate? Cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a super therapy we're going to talk about, 6.1%, 3.4 had both, opioids in 33%, and NSAIDs in 70%. So lessons learned. In spite of what I just told you, here's a study of 3,123 U.S. adult fibro patients over 11 years of age. Okay? It's a lot of patients. 46.7% used opioids. 12.5% used strong opioids. Over the 11 years, severity-adjusted opioid use increased from 6.3 to 11.7%, and any opioid use dropped from 80 to 46.6. NSAID use decreased from 74% to 44%. TCA dropped from 27 to 15%, but new central acting drugs use increased at the beginning, or from the beginning, 10% to 39% over that 11-year period of this study. Overall, pain, fatigue, and the HAQ scores were unchanged. Think of that. Pain scores were unchanged. There was no significant improvement in fatigue or functional ability. Another study in the U.S. used 538 patients. And this was from six rheumatology centers that specialized in treating fibromyalgia. All right? More than 90% of these patients took at least one medication. They all had an average of three, all right, used for the treatment of fibro. But NSAIDs were most commonly prescribed, okay, followed by the TCAs. And opioids were used by 7%. And this is a good part of the rest of the talk. No evidence whatsoever exists that opioids work in fibromyalgia. None. Zero. Zip. And I'll show you why opioids may even make fibro worse. Okay? Now, think about the studies we just discussed and the number of patients in those studies who received NSAIDs and received opioids, which there are no RCTs, randomized controlled trials, that show that they're effective. So, CSF levels in endogenous opioids, including beta-endorphin, metenkeflin, normal. But in these patients, fibro patients and chronic low back pain patients, metenkeflin, ARG6, Fe7, or MEEP, is another endogenous opioid, is markedly increased in the CSF. And what do you think happens? Pain threshold decreases. The higher the level of MEEP in the body, the lower the pain threshold. So what's happening? That shouldn't be that way. That's an endogenous opiate, right? So the patient should be able to have a higher pain threshold, right? No. You can see here, if you want to study this, increased MEEP, decreased pain threshold. Okay? There's an impairment of mu opioid receptors in fibromyalgia. Okay? They have impaired functioning of the mu opioid receptor, abnormal pain signal processing. And it's to the point, actually, where people are wondering if the mu opioid receptors and their binding potential, which is diminished, are either downregulated or upregulated, because if you use an opioid, it increases pain for some of these patients. So we talked about MEEP, opioid binding, same thing that I was just telling you. Again, you see increased effective pain with increased mu opioid receptor binding potential. So it's not just pain, but it's affective discomfort, depression, anxiety, and the like. This is a functional MRI of what in the humans. This is where all the pain, the mu opioid receptors are localized in the brain. Okay? And again, no RCTs have been done. Okay? Now, this is an interesting article. Treatment in the first year after fibro diagnosis by quarter, and up in the top there is the use of fibromyalgia specific drugs, the three, the big three. And then secondly is fibromyalgia guideline only, and this is opioid plus fibromyalgia appropriate drug, and down here is just opioids. And so you see over the year, just opioids goes down, opioid with fibromyalgia stays about the same, and here's fibromyalgia guideline, looks about the same, but fibromyalgia, no fibromyalgia guideline treatment or opioid, typically that's NSAIDs are populating those groups. And NSAIDs and opioids, as we discussed, don't help. So, again, next time I'd put a slide for naltrexone. Exercise is probably the treatment of choice for fibromyalgia patients, okay, as well as other painful rheumatic disorders, okay? And it's typically cardiovascular exercise, as what we know is that moderate to high affinity resistance, weights, all these things are not helpful to these fibro patients, okay? Doing water-based exercises can be very helpful for these folk. And then there's other types of exercises. Tai Chi, it's wonderful. Okay, 28-week Tai Chi program, improved pain, functional capacity, symptoms of including sleep. Qigong, not so much. CBT, I love CBT if you can find somebody to do it, cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay, what it should do for the patients is teach them relaxation techniques. It should give them goal setting, problem solving, self-reinforcement, and most importantly, teaching them how to substitute maladaptive thoughts, okay, with positive thoughts. Okay, CBT, there's a study, 145 fibro patients randomly assigned. They did well. They did better. Okay, this is a interesting type of graph just showing that CBT is helpful. Other modalities, acupuncture has very mixed results. If you look at the papers, some say it's great, some say it doesn't affect anything at all. Massage, one study showed 5 weeks of massage made the patient's pain, anxiety, and depression in fibromyalgia better. Okay, again, I talked to you about tender and trigger point injections. Tender point injections, trigger point injections, if you do it correctly and get rid of the trigger point, really good. TENS units, short-term efficacy in decreasing symptoms of fibro. Here's a systemic review determined that Tai Chi, yoga, meditation, mindfulness-based interventions, hypnosis, guided imagery, EMG biofeedback, and hydrotherapy were effective treatments, but Qigong, acupuncture, chiropractic interventions, EEG biofeedback, nutritional supplements, not so much. Okay, non-invasive brain stimulation using transcranial magnetic stimulation. Okay, nothing spectacular. Education and multidisciplinary treatment. I only know of one group doing a specific fibromyalgia multidisciplinary group, and that's in University of Washington, Seattle. It's run by Dennis Turk. Good program, 4-week program. Now, restless legs. This is classified as a neurological sensory disorder, okay? And you'll find out in a moment that it's far more populated in terms of up to 10% of Americans have this disorder versus 6 to 7% of Americans with fibromyalgia. Symptoms are most common in late afternoon or evening, more severe at night. Symptoms are pain, the feeling of, I've got to move my leg. If I can't move my leg, it starts to hurt until you do move your leg. And RLS can be primary, idiopathic, or it can be secondary. And the things it can be secondary to, one of the most important is decreased iron in the brain, okay, and the body. As well as pregnancy, anytime during pregnancy, this can come on. One study showed it was 25% in third trimester. And chronic kidney failure is the third most common. So it affects 7 to 10% of the population in this country. That's enormous, all right? So 2.5 to 3% experience daily or severe symptoms. Sometimes the symptoms can be so severe, the only treatment has been in the past the use of an opioid. Good luck getting it now. But that's what was used, All right. It's women twice, 2 to 1 versus men. Caucasians more so than African Americans. But otherwise, 1 to 5% in Far Eastern, the Asian population, Mediterranean or Middle Eastern, 3%. Risk factors, older age, family history of RLS. Pregnancy, as I told you, uremia, low iron levels, kidney failure, Parkinson's disease, and I'll show you why in a minute, diabetes and rheumatoid arthritis. Okay, neurological associations are risk factors, Parkinson's disease, lumbosacral radiculopathy, periodic limb movement disorder, or periodic limb movement in sleep. And medications that can cause RLS or make it worse include older antihistamines like diphenhydramine, antiemetics, metoclopramide or prochlorperazine, antipsychotics, haloperidol, olanzapine, lithium, SSRIs, okay, fluoxetine, sertraline or escitalopram, TCAs, amitriptyline, tramadol, and levothyroxine. Okay, pathophysiology is most likely at this as much as we know now, is secondary to abnormal use of iron in the brain and or low levels of iron in the brain. Okay, there's dysfunction of the basal ganglia, which control movements. That dysfunction will increase movements. And the movements can be, they're always involuntary, but they can be stretching, they can be out, you know, straightening out the lower limb, but they can also be kicking. I have patients who come in with RLS and their spouses, they're saying, yeah, you know, I got black and blue marks for my husband or my wife kicking me when they're sleeping. So the diagnosis, there's 5 points to confirm the diagnosis. All right, strong urge to move the limbs, usually associated with unpleasant or uncomfortable feelings. It starts or worsens during inactivity or rest. It improves or disappears temporarily during activity. It worsens in the evening. It worsens at night, anytime. Symptoms are not caused by any medical or behavioral condition. Differential diagnosis. Not going to go through it, leg cramps and so on, but notice peripheral neuropathies, anxiety, and myalgia. How do you work it up? The first thing you want to do is do a total iron workup, looking for iron deficiency. Iron levels, ferritin, transferrin saturation, and total iron binding capacity is important. Otherwise, it's a pretty routine workup, unless on examination you find something that shouldn't be there. If you find polyneuropathy or peripheral neuropathy or radiculopathy, patient will need an EMG and NCV. If their spouse says they're kicking the hell out of me, all right, you want to do polysomnography. Two reasons. You want to look for limb movements while asleep, and you also want to look for sleep architecture. Now, treatment. The primary treatment, okay, after you treat for iron replacement if you need to, consider effective medications. Get rid of medications that can increase RLS. Recommend to the patient no caffeine, no alcohol, no nicotine. All right. The three most common drugs, there's now four, but the three most common is pramipexole, 0.125 milligrams. Secondly, ropinirole, 0.25 milligrams, and retigotine. What are these? These are dopamine agonists. They increase the ability of the dopaminergic system to function appropriately. Okay? My preferred drug of the three is retigotine. It's a 24-hour patch. Now, the other thing that's commonly used is gabapentin, 1 to 300 milligrams at night, but I believe there's been a recent FDA approval for gabapentin and carbaryl, Horizant, okay, which is an extended release of a new form, different form of gabapentin for RLS. Benzos, I wouldn't use them. I don't use them. Opioids, good luck. And the FDA has approved a vibrating blanket called Relaxis. All right, we'll end there and ask for questions.